From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in.
And joining us today for the first part of the show is Hadley Dynack. She's the former executive director of the Park City and Summit County Arts Council, who recently moved back to California and is now sort of the owner and caretaker of the Western Hills Garden. Hadley, thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want you to share this story of how you and Kent came to be the owners and caretakers of this unique place.
Well, it's really that this place came to us. We, you know, have long talked about owning a property that could be a space for friends and family, come together, good food, good music, creative expression, community gathering, all that stuff, and didn't really ever know what that was going to look like. And, you know, from time to time, we would look at properties or talk about things with friends. And we actually, as you mentioned, you know, had lived in Park City and sold our home in Park City, which we had been renting since we moved back to California. And during the sale, a friend of ours sent us this listing. It happened to be a listing by the same brokerage where we were selling our house through. So we called our agent from Sotheby's, and they called here, and we saw the place the next week, and we were in contract a week later. So it's a little bit like, I don't know, I liken it to finding our street rescue dog, Lily, in that it just kind of came to us, and we saw it, and we said, let's subscribe to the real estate rule where you say yes and then look for the reasons why not afterwards.
I like it. I like that perspective.
Yeah, it's really magical. I mean, I can't describe the history and the majesty of this place. I mean, you can't help but feel connected to the earth in a deeper way when you walk around.
All right, well, then explain what this property is about and, let's say, the history of it.
Yeah. Well, it's a really interesting story and one of the things that drew us to this place because it gave us something to build on. We're the fourth owners, and the property was acquired in 1959 by Lester Hawkins and Marshall Ulbrich, two guys that lived in San Francisco, and I think were looking for a little bit less hustle and bustle, but also a place where they could really explore some of their maybe anti-capitalist or anti-consumer ideas. They were not gardeners, which actually gives us some solace because we are not horticulturalists or botanists or I mean, we love gardening, but we're learning a tremendous amount. So they acquired it in 1959 for $2,300 that Marshall had gotten as an inheritance. And they just started to think about what this 3-acre property should be, and they started to build these what they call runnels, which are irrigation drenches, basically to get water running off through the property, and thought about more Mediterranean, you know, California native plants initially. And then they started exploring the idea of bringing in rare and exotic plants from other parts of the world. They really were kind of the first to do that, at least in Northern California, and really became experts. And the garden became an epicenter of a new type of horticultural thinking that has really influenced the Bay Area landscape design since they started. They bequeathed the property after Lester died first and then Marshall died, and they bequeathed it to their beloved gardener who had worked with them for a long, long time, Maggie Witch. And she kind of pushed the property further, and she did all this incredible stonework in these runnels. So now they not only are functional, but they're beautiful. And she installed this gorgeous folly that was inspired by this English designer, Penelope Hobhouse. And then she got to a point where she could no longer care for it, and the property actually went into foreclosure. It was sold to a couple of people that weren't able to maintain it. And the people we bought it from, Chris and Tim Cebulski, acquired it and they had it for about 11 years. And they really pushed the property forward in terms of some capital improvements. They rebuilt the farmhouse, the main farmhouse where we live, and they did a lot of improvements to irrigation and updating and kind of maintained the legacy, which is what we are hoping to do as well, you know, preserve and protect and steward and then push forward maybe some new programming and sustainability efforts.
Yeah, I was just about to ask more about that. Kind of, I know it's probably a little bit early to ask this, but what is your vision for the future of the garden and as it relates to the plants that you have there or community engagement or connecting with nature?
Yeah, well, the property is really an incredible example of what I think of as cultivated biodiversity because it's home to, you know, native plant species, as well as these rare and important, and in some cases endangered plants. You can't be on the property and not feel connected to something larger than yourself when you're here. So we want to build on that. We definitely want to have the garden be a community resource. It's been closed to the public for the last couple of years because of the pandemic and the sale. So we are hoping this spring to reopen to visitors, and we'll launch a membership program and additional programming that will have some horticultural aspects, but also, you know, tying into my love and history with art and culture, trying to bring in artists of all types to be inspired and inspire others with what they can offer as well.
Describe some of the biodiversity that's there, particularly some of the rare and unusual species of plants.
Yeah, so there are a lot of Australians, which is really interesting, a lot of Asian, Chinese, and Japanese trees. In fact, some people really think of the property almost more of an arboretum in terms of the importance of the trees than a garden, although there are thousands of plants. As far as you look, in fact, every like little square inch of the property, it is developed with plants and pathways and bridges and ponds. And so you can look in like a little tiny, place right in front of you off a path and see five or six different things. So it's just kind of this explosion, sensory explosion of living things. I think, you know, there's so many stories to go into, but one of the interesting stories is that we have two Willemi pines. And so Willemi pines are these prehistoric plants that were found, I think like in the early 90s maybe, by these explorers and plant researchers in Australia. They were like discovering or exploring these canyons outside of Sydney, about 100 miles outside of Sydney, and they found these, like what they think to be maybe 40 million year old trees that date back. And so we have two of those on our property, and we're trying that. They're a plant that has both a male and a female in its tree. And so we're hoping we can maybe do some propagating. We've already got some seedlings that are sprouting around the bottom of them. So that's pretty exciting. And that's just one story. I mean, there's like the largest Chilean wine palm outside of Kew Gardens on the property. And a camellia forest. I guess in the past there have been all of these tours that come through of garden clubs and, you know, associations of plant lovers of different types. So the Camellia Society has historically come through every year to look at how the camellia bloom is going, and the Conifer Society has come through and, you know, inspect the trees and have conversations about how the trees are going. So we're really excited to, you know, draw upon the love of the property by so many people and also the kind of wisdom and knowledge base that they can offer.
Right.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Hadley Dynack. She is the owner and caretaker of Western Hills Garden in California, and of course, formerly the executive director of the Park City Summit County Arts Council here locally. And we're talking to her about the plans for this garden. Hadley, as you talk about your love of art and also all of the sort of incredible horticultural wonders on site, I have to ask, how do you think that art and like this sensory explosion, as you described it. How do you think that can help people connect with or understand nature?
Well, I think that the connection between art and nature, you know, runs deep, right? We are inspired by the natural environment, whatever that is. And so artists are kind of the culture makers. They're able to take those ideas that they are inspired by or that they are seeing and represent those back to the public in a new way, to maybe push thinking or offer a new perspective on something. So that's one of the things that we really want to offer creatives, is a place over time, and this is probably the 5-year plan, but we really would love to build out a small residency program where artists could come, and maybe writers or horticultural researchers, at the same time as, you know, musicians or fine artists, to create something that reflects the synergy of all of the different points of view that these people bring. It won't be a robust residency, but, you know, like a week or two at a time with a couple people. And I think, you know, a lot of what we're thinking right now is that we don't know what we're going to do. So we have these ideas, but it's really about building partnerships with the community and with others that we meet along the way, to figure out, you know, what that palette looks like. I mean, the property itself, in a way, can be a metaphor as well as a living place to come and reflect. So we're playing with both of those ideas, and we're planning to run it as a nonprofit. We're working on getting all of the, you know, bureaucratic details set up right now, and in the meantime are looking for a fiscal sponsor that will be able to help us raise money for it and set up a membership program and build out, you know, all of these other things that we're talking about. One of the things related to your show that I think is interesting is, you know, Lester and Marshall had this idea of natives initially, and then brought in these other plants that could thrive in California's Mediterranean climate. So we're seeing how all of these different plants from all over the world can exist together. And I think that it's really incredible to walk around the garden and see things that you wouldn't see anywhere else because of how they've been placed. And we want to, you know, like I said, steward and extend that, but also look at ways that we can make the garden more sustainable. So that's, you know, looking at anything that we put in that's more drought tolerant, looking at how we can reduce the water impact, because you might imagine, you know, 3 acres with all of this plant life requires a lot of water, and water is such a scarce resource everywhere, and particularly in California. So we're trying to, you know, look at strategies for reducing that. We're not using commercial fertilizers, you know, moving more toward natural fertilizers, and so exploring how we can keep things going and alive and robust, but also a little bit more sustainable.
And given the complex nature of the biodiversity out there, how about pests or insects, mold or other oddities and challenges that you face in a system like that?
Well, we acquired the property in September, so we are still becoming very familiar with it, I would say. And every day, you know, the garden changes, right, given that it's a living ecosystem.
Yeah.
So I think it's fenced, so that's a wonderful thing from preventing the deer on the property, because I think there probably wouldn't be a garden if there wasn't a fence, because
right,
there are deer everywhere that would like to eat it. And, you know, there are gophers, but we have 2 garden cats that roam the property and try to keep them a little bit in check, although there's the kind of push-pull contrast, because then the cats also like the birds,
right,
and we want to protect the birds.
Sure.
Interestingly, I was not aware of this, but I guess it's the first Sunday of every new year, the National Audubon Society has its annual bird count.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we got a call like the day before from the local chapter that was doing the Western Sonoma County bird count. And we're like, oh my gosh, yes, you have to come through. And I had never seen them in action or really even heard about this annual event. So we were able to identify 15 different species in their 45-minute count around the property. So obviously the birds are doing okay with the two cats on the property. So I don't know about the challenges of mold. I think that, you know, it's a wet environment, so the structures definitely get a lot of pests and dry rot and things, as often happens in Northern California. So those are just, you know, operational things that we'll have to stay on top of. But one of the things that I think is really interesting about mold, or related to mold, is the kind of interconnection between the tree roots and the mycelium. And you can actually see it, like when you're digging in the garden, you see these white strands, and it's just so magical to think about that and think about the new research about, you know, the tree communication and support system in a new way, given the research that's coming out about that.
Mm-hmm. Have you found that there's a community of people sort of ready and willing to help with their own expertise? Like, your surprise call from, you know, the local Audubon Society made me think, like, you may have had some interesting surprises like that.
We have had many, and I suspect there'll be many more. I mean, like I said earlier, one of the things that drew us to the place was that there was this history that we could build on and learn from and appreciate. So there are many, many people with many stories that that they share occasionally when we meet people. So one guy just showed up, and we're not open to the public, as I said. So it's a little bit surprising when someone's at the gate. And he came in, and he was a new hire from the Sonoma Botanical Garden. Mm. I think he was from the Midwest. And his title was Curator of Living Things. And he was coming because he had heard about this particular Acer penophyllum that we have, which is a rare maple. And he was tracking, you know, the lineage of this particular plant. They had some on their property, and apparently this one tree on our property is one of the mother trees in the entire area that I think was propagated from another one that was in the Thriving Arboretum in Golden Gate Park. So that was just another random, like, oh, he's here and he wants to look at this tree. So we learned a lot about the tree from him. And today is Tuesday, and Tuesday is volunteer day. So we have a group of volunteers that range anywhere from about 5 to 7 people that come. Many are master gardeners, and they just love being here, so they help us with pruning and propagating and deciding, you know, what needs to move or come out. And we're really trying to be careful not to do too much, because we haven't been here for a full year yet. So, like I said, every day it changes, and we can't wait for spring, because talk about explosion. I think it's going to be incredible. And right now the garden is very quiet because, you know, it's the winter, and right. So all the deciduous trees have lost their leaves, and, you know, you see across the garden in a way that you couldn't when we first came to the property. So I can't wait to see when the leaves all come out again.
Well, Hadley, I love your story about the horticulturalist or the botanist showing up in search of a specific plant. In my work at Swanner Preserve, this is something that will happen like every couple years. Somebody will come and say, I am in search of this very specific, very rare plant. Mm. You know, it was described in this area in the early 1900s or something. Or I, you know, saw in this herbarium that you have a specimen here. And it's always so fascinating to learn the stories behind these.
People that you don't know.
Right. You don't know, you've never heard from, you've never met. But it seems like it could be kind of tie back to your initial comment about this place, that it could be a way to bring people together from a variety of different places and backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what that looks like exactly, but that is definitely a vision. And I think that ties back to, you know, both the very real, obvious thing that you can see when you're walking around the property with this diversity, but also the metaphor of it. Like, how do all these living things from all over the place exist together? How do people with very little resources and knowledge develop an asset like this, and that has become loved by so many and influential to so many, you know, I don't know exactly what we can do to preserve and maintain that, but that is our goal. And so, you know, starting with inviting people to come, having a lot of conversations with people, listening, asking questions. We have a survey on our website where we ask people to share their Western Hills garden story with us, because so many people have stories to share, you know. Or like, I had a friend stop by for her birthday this weekend, and her husband is a contractor, and he was doing a remodel for a landscape designer in the Bay Area, and said he was coming up here. And this woman was like, oh my gosh, I know that place. I used to buy plants there. And so it's like the ripple effect of a legacy. And, you know, Lester and Marshall, the way that they ran it, it was a functioning operational nursery. Mm. And Maggie continued it on as a nursery. And then over time, you know, the last 20 years or so, many, many nurseries have popped up. So it becomes much more difficult to, you know, keep a nursery going with the revenue because of the competition and the challenges with our particular property not having a ton of parking. So I think we will probably sell some plants that we propagate here. In fact, there are some plants that actually were propagated here. There's a Western Hills Garden Hebe, for example. So we'll probably sell things like that that have a real connection to this particular place. And then, you know, more offering it as a refuge for people to come and, you know, escape right, and contemplate. You know, the natural environment, I think we can all agree, has really become such a refuge for so many during the pandemic in particular. And so that's one of the core things that we're thinking about.
Right. I just wrote down learn and reflect. That's what I picture your place, to come and learn about biodiversity, learn about rare plants, et cetera, and maybe a few rare, odd insects and such that you're learning every day, I'm sure, as you walk around.
Yes.
What is this? That's the question I'm sure. What is this?
Well, and it is. You like pull back a plant to like weed, and you see three other plants under there. You're like, oh my gosh, what is this?
And should I pull that? You know,
I know. Oh. Yeah, I try not to pull too much.
Okay, that's a good behavior practice right now. Last couple minutes. What is the website?
The website is westernhillsgarden.com. Mm-hmm. And we have a newsletter that we're going to start sending out, probably not very often. So if you are wanting to track us and our endeavors, that's a good thing to sign up for. It's on the homepage and I think somewhere else. And then we've launched an Instagram account, which is also Western Hills Garden, where we're kind of tracking daily some of the things we're seeing or thinking or doing with the property. And then we do also have a legacy Facebook account that we acquired from the previous owners. We're not posting that as much, but for people that like Facebook, that's there too.
Right. And like you say, eventually you'll open up to the public. Will Park City residents get like 10% off?
I'm sure if you drop the Park City connection, we can arrange something. Yes. We're definitely going to do a membership for Sonoma County locals because we want to make it accessible, and a community asset for locals.
And I think there might be some locals who want to learn more about how maybe they can establish their own gardens, some county version of a Western Hills garden.
Exactly.
Hadley, so great to speak with you. Hadley Dynack, the caretaker, along with her husband, Ken, of Western Hills Gardens in Occidental, California. And I have to say that we owe special thanks to Barb Bretz, local park guide, who made us aware of your gardens just last week. Barb said, you need to talk to Hadley about her gardens and her experience here.
Barb is such a champion. Well, I'm grateful for her. And
it's a great example of our show, who people reach out. We want to cover stories that are local. This is sort of local too. So Hadley.
And it's definitely connected to Park City. And follow along. We'll have much more to say as we get further into this journey.
All right. We'll be in touch then. Hadley, thanks so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
All right, let's take a break for underwriters. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with Jordan Clayton. He's the data collection officer with the Utah Snow Survey. And we'll be talking about snowfall, rainfall in some parts, and
moisture contents.
Yeah, and how we're doing here in the state with respect to our drought. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, encouraging you to start your morning off right with KPCW. Join us each weekday morning here on KPCW starting at 5. We'll bring you national and international news from NPR, while the KPCW news team brings you local headlines. Our world is ever-changing, so stay up to date and informed right here on KPCW.
Studies show that volunteering boosts happiness and supports overall good mental health. The Christian Center of Park City is looking for people to be a part of our happy, healthy, helpful team of volunteers that support our mission of meeting people at their point of need. We have opportunities in our food pantry, thrift stores, and boutique, and at our Heber location. More information on how to be a volunteer is available at ccofpc.org under the Get Involved link at the top of the page. The Christian Center of Park City is a nonprofit organization supporting KPCW.
Hi, I'm Rachel Martin from NPR's Morning Edition. Heard here on KPCW every weekday morning, right before the local news hour with Leslie Thatcher. We are public radio powered by you. You. Please consider supporting this local radio station with a tax-deductible financial donation. It's really easy. Just go to kpcw.org and click the donate button right at the top of the screen.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us for the second part of the show is Jordan Clayton. He's the data collection officer with the Utah Snow Survey. Every month they put out a report all about precipitation, soil moisture content, water reservoir capacities, etc. All things water, and now snow. And we're here to talk about how we're doing here with respect to the drought. We're still in a drought here in the state of one form or another. Jordan, thanks so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. Let's go back. I think last time here we were talking about maybe November's water report. November was fairly dry, if I could recall. And then December arrived, which started off, I believe, also dry until the second half of the month. Then what happened?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. We've had quite a roller coaster winter, or at least water year, I should say, so far, starting in the beginning of October. Close to 200% of normal statewide precipitation in October. So we started off the water year really on a good footing. We had that early snow up in the mountains. And then, as you said, things really dried out in November, close to 40% of normal precipitation for the state in November, and then we bounced back the other direction, up to 200, actually a little bit more than 200% of normal precipitation in December, and then the beginning of January was also excellent. So we keep going back and forth, and now, of course, we've been in a dry pattern of the last week and a half or so, and it looks like that's going to continue for about at least another week, week and a half, with some promising I'm hearing about some promising changes for the end of the month.
Hmm. All right. We'll get to some of the details there a little later. But this whipsaw effect going on these last 4 months or so, is that normal for this time of year, or is it maybe a bit unusual to see this rate of whipsaw?
Yeah, it's certainly been extreme. It's kind of hard to tease out if this kind of whipsaw, as you called it, which I think is a good way to put it, if that's normal or not. But it's from a perspective of a water supply and what we're storing in our snowpack, we'll take it either way. Certainly, it causes us to go on alarm, you know, when we get these dry months and then feel like we're getting relief when we don't. But we'll take it either way.
And the majority of the state, say, going into October, was in either an exceptional or extreme drought conditions. Has that changed?
Yeah, great question. We are thankful that at this point, none of the state is in that D4 exceptional drought category. So that's a big improvement. We were really for quite a long time in a situation where large chunks of the state were both D3 and D4, which is, as you said, extreme and exceptional drought. Now there's no D4 in the state. There is, unfortunately, still 100% either D2 or D3. Sorry, I should say 94%. So 94% of the state is still in a condition of severe, which is D2, or extreme, which is D3 drought. And so, you know, we get kind of lost in the semantics here, but the take home is there's a lot of the state that's still way behind from a water supply perspective. And you start to get into the nuance of this a little bit. Meteorologically, we're catching up. We're doing a little bit better. It's understandable that when you define drought just in terms of how much precipitation we have relative to normal, that you'd start to consider the state on the rebound. From a hydrological perspective, where you look at actually how much storage we have and how our water supply systems are doing, and that's a little bit harder to get out of. It takes us longer to get into hydrological drought, and it takes us longer to come out of it. And so from that perspective, we still have a lot of extreme drought in the state.
I was going to ask, you know, how these, you know, D2, D3, D4 categories are determined. You know, is that how much water storage we've got in our reservoir? Is that how much precipitation we've seen? Like, how is that determined?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's a fascinating process. I feel lucky to be part of those conversations at this point. Our office supplies snowpack and soil moisture data in particular, but we also talk about other parameters measured at our snowtell sites for those conversations. And they typically happen every 2 weeks. And the group will involve folks that are bringing in modeled information, satellite information, of course, our on-the-ground weather stations. Those all get used. And so what we'll do is we'll sort of trade off 5 to 10 minute briefings and talk about how things are doing from different perspectives of different agencies. Again, bringing in all those different perspectives on conditions. And then it will also bring in a perspective of how the reservoirs are doing. We'll hear representatives from various corners of the state talk about what they're seeing on the ground. That doesn't necessarily relate to a weather station, but it has to do with what producers and ranchers are saying in terms of how dry things are. So it's a nice combination of both what the instruments are reporting, what the satellites are seeing, and also what's being observed on the ground. And from that, it's a little bit of a combination of science and art that the drought authors use to put together these maps.
So how are the reservoirs doing?
Yeah, so in the state of Utah, we're at 50% of capacity right now, which is kind of good news and bad news. The good news is that we anticipated, if we rewind the clock and go back to around July, we anticipated that we would be closer to 30% capacity or maybe 35% capacity at this time. And we actually, I don't know if I mentioned this before in the show, but we did a good job as a state conserving water towards the end of the summer. Also benefited from a really surprisingly strong monsoon season, which doesn't necessarily replenish our reservoirs, but it does decrease our rate of withdrawals from those reservoirs. And so there's more water left in the bucket, so to speak, than we anticipated. So that's good news. The bad news is that 50% of capacity is not great. So we have a long way to go to replenish the rest of those buckets. And certain basins in the state are particularly hard hit. The upper Sevier in particular has a lot of capacity that it has to rebuild. And I'm thinking of Sevier Bridge or Yuba Reservoir in particular, which is really low right now. But there's others in that system that could use a lot of water. The Provo system actually is also another one I would add to that list. A lot of capacity to store water in the Provo system, and therefore a lot of capacity to rebuild that storage right now where those reservoirs are also down from where they should be.
And when you say the Provo system, that includes portions of Summit County?
That's correct.
Okay. So if 50% is, let's say, not good, what percentage is preferable? Obviously 100%, but I don't think we need to get to 100%. What would be a good number?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know that I necessarily have a number at my fingertips that would be our sort of goalpost that we're shooting for, other than, as you said, you know, the obvious, which is that we want to be closer to that 100% where we can have that maximum storage to be able to fall back on when we get to more dry years. It's looking promising based on our runoff forecast that we'll be able to replenish some of our reservoir systems. Our surface water supply indexes that we publish with the reports that you mentioned at the top of the segment, those combine current reservoir storage for a given basin with what we're forecasting in terms of runoff from the snowpack for that basin to give a sense for how much water will we have available during the summer months from April through July. And there are some areas of the state that are looking promising from that perspective. The Virgin River in particular is one that jumps out. And then other areas, as I was just saying, like the Provo, kind of stand out for being a little bit lower. And it's not that we don't have good snowpack in the Provo. It's just that those reservoirs are drawn down quite a bit, and we're going to need a lot of water to build that back up.
So we've been in a drought-like situation for quite some time. Are you seeing behavior change with respect to large water users, ag interests, municipal water demand? Is behavior changing in that area?
Yeah, I suspect that it has. I apologize. We don't really track that, right, in our office, although we, of course, work with water managers. And I have been in meetings where there's been discussions on this topic, so it's not that it's unfamiliar, but I couldn't really report back a specific behavioral change or percent of reduction in use or anything like that. But I will say that there's definitely been an improvement statewide. I'm a little bit concerned right now with the above average snowpack conditions that we have, that the perception is going to be, well, we got what we need, this drought situation's in the rearview mirror, which is definitely not the case, and that's a concern. We do have a nice layer of snow on the ground. We're about 125% of normal for this time of year, which is fantastic. We're at the statewide level about 9 inches of snow water equivalent, and we would need about 5.5 more, again, from a statewide perspective, to get to what we would call normal peak snowpack by the beginning of April. So we're ahead of 50% on that, and that's great. Of course, there are some areas of the state that are doing better than others. The southern portion of the state is doing great right now, but it looks like that's an area where we might not get more precipitation at the end of this month, so I'm worried about that area falling behind. So there's a lot of nuance here that I hope people will consider.
You know, as we were talking about the drought category and we were sort of celebrating the fact that we're no longer in exceptional drought, I think it hit home when our best case scenario right now is that we're in severe drought. And that is a good thing for us to remember. We're still in severe drought.
Right.
It's just maybe not as.
Hey, everybody, it's only severe.
No big deal.
We're out of the exceptional.
Yeah, we're still in the hospital, but we're not in the ICU. How about that?
I like that.
Okay. All right. And that is interesting because I've talked to some people and I try to explain. It's like, yeah, we're in severe to extreme drought conditions. It's like, how can you possibly say that? Look at all the snow.
Right.
I.e., water that's going to come out of the mountains in the spring. But like you say, we're in a deficit. That is we have a big deficit to make up. And we need a lot more precipitation to help make up that deficit.
Yeah, that's correct. And the other thing that I would ask folks to keep in mind is, even if we get to that 100% replenishment of our reservoir supply, we have another concern here, which is the Great Salt Lake, which is down quite a bit. And it's going to take more than one above average snowpack year to start to rebuild in a more meaningful way the level of the Great Salt Lake, which has all kinds of ramifications. And so, you know, that's going to be the bottom of the pipe. All the other buckets are going to get filled before the Salt Lake starts to get some of that water. And so I am also concerned about if it's just this winter and if we do wind up with above average snowpack conditions, that's great, but that probably won't improve the condition of the Salt Lake significantly. And so we're going to need really multiple years of significant significant snowfall above normal snowfall to start rebuilding the lake level. And again, that has widespread impacts for the state.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because Chris and I have obviously talked about that with other guests and other contexts. But when we talk about water and drought, we are so focused on the reservoirs that we use for, of course, the water that we need on a daily basis, right? But we often overlook the fact that our, you know, our largest in area water body in the state has been suffering. And like you said, there are so many impacts, ecological impacts, right, but also sort of this concern about dust that will then sort of have a feedback cycle, right, and impact our snow and the melting in future years.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the impacts that we, from a snow survey perspective, are very concerned about. All the downwind areas could be impacted by the increased dust on the snowpack, which changes its reflectivity and makes it easier to absorb the sun's energy, making it therefore easier to melt. And so that's not a cycle, as you mentioned, that's a positive feedback cycle, but that's one that we want to avoid. There is the potential to decrease, with decreased lake area, just by having a smaller lake area, you decrease the lake effect on those downwind areas when we do get storms. That's definitely one that we're concerned about. Of course, as you said, the ecological impacts, there's a huge brine shrimp industry, which is a more than $1 billion industry for the state. I mean, we're talking about a lot of different things that are coupled with the lake level. And so it is definitely a concern going into the long term.
All right, last couple minutes. You did suggest that we could be seeing some snowfall for precipitation. Maybe, there's forecasts one day or so this week, but maybe a little more down the road next week?
Correct. And again, we measure the snow that does fall. Our office doesn't forecast, but at the same time, of course, we watch what the forecasters are saying. And there are some reports from the folks that kind of get into the deeper analysis and look at what the multi-week trends might produce. There are some suggestions that northern Utah in particular, from a maybe three-week perspective, is going to see some above-average precipitation in that time category. Potentially other areas of the state as well. It's looking like there might be a pattern change towards the end of the month. Not a lot of confidence this far out, but at least it's something that we can cross our fingers about.
Well, we'll certainly hope for that. And, you know, we'll be aiming to get out of this extreme drought just into the severe drought,
severe,
right?
And then what's after severe? Is there any other better word? Is it encouraging that, where do we go from severe? Just bad?
Yeah, below severe, it gets into D1, which is moderate drought.
Oh, okay.
Which is, I think a little bit less alarming. And then D0 is just abnormally dry, which doesn't really cause much action, but it's just something that is on people's radar when we get there.
Okay.
What words do you use when we have too much precipitation?
Too much precipitation is called heaven.
All right. That's it. There you
Perfect.
Go. There's our aspirational goal. There's our stretch goal for the for weather and climate. Jordan Clayton, data collection officer with the Utah Snow Survey. Hey, Jordan, a website so people can go on and track information that we're talking about.
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. Our website is kind of long and convoluted, but the easiest thing to do is type into your search engine, Utah Snow Survey, and we're typically the top thing that pops up.
Got it.
Perfect.
Jordan, thanks as always for joining us. Hey, we will be in touch sometime in the middle of next month.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you very much.
All right. Hey, I think we got one more underwriter. Let's cover that. And when we come back, we got an item or two in the news. We have some time for that. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Ah, winter. It's better with open space. If you love skiing the steep and deep of Empire and Lady Morgan at Deer Valley, or striding and gliding on Perfect Corduroy in Round Valley in the McPolin Farmlands, you're enjoying the precious lands that Summit Land Conservancy protects. More than 80% of our protected properties offer public access and opportunities for adventure. Learn more at wesaveland.org. The Summit Land Conservancy is a local nonprofit and KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to This Green Earth weekly talk show. Hey, about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. Just exactly what we were talking with Jordan about.
Yeah.
Those two, how we relate to water, what water obviously means to us. And now you brought up a really good point, too, because we think of water in terms of how we consume it, mm-hmm. and satisfying our needs.
Right.
Drinking and watering our lawns and golf courses, etc. But there is an environmental impact associated with extreme and severe drought, this Great Salt Lake being you know, the biggest evidence of that. But all ecosystems are impacted in one form or another.
Right. Okay. As well as human health. So it's with this Great Salt Lake issue, you know, with the dust and the heavy metals and all these kinds of things, it goes so far, so far beyond just what we need to water our lawns, you know, but
so
wildlife health, our health, our, you know, $1 billion economy based on the lake. There's a lot. There's a lot going on
there. And that's why I like to cover it every month. We got a couple minutes. I wanted to cover this story about this major find of, ice fish nest. That sounds very like, so what moment.
But this is like such an incredible.
Unbelievable. Researchers out, I'm trying to find here in a story I got, they were looking for other things. Like so many times your researchers are down with their cameras going around the deep parts of the oceans of the Weddell Sea. This is a body of water off the coast of Antarctica, and they come upon these nests of ice fish. Now, they're familiar. Ice fish are really interesting themselves because they don't have, their blood runs clear. They have no red blood cells.
Right.
Because they live 1,000 feet down in water that is just above freezing. So basically, their blood is a part antifreeze. So they survive. Okay. The point is, they come upon these nest after nest. Ultimately, the rough count is that they discovered 60 million of these nests along the bottom of roughly 90 square miles of this bottom of the Weddell Sea.
It's incredible.
Heretofore unknown. That's what's the amazing thing.
And that's, I agree, that is the amazing thing, because there's still so much about our world, particularly our oceans, that we just don't know. We don't even know what's there, what we're impacting, what's changing.
Right, and what can benefit us, maybe,
right,
in some way or not. You know, and so I'll say, while Jeff and Elon and Sir Richard are launching rockets to go visit dead planets, there's still so much about this one we have yet to explore and understand and discover.
Right.
So, all right. That's my little...
We could go so far as to say appreciate, protect.
Yeah. If Jeff and Elon and Sir Richard went down instead of up, how about that?
Yeah.
We did some more exploration. So anyway, all these nests, further research. Before the end of their research, the researchers deployed a camera that will photograph these nesting areas twice daily for the next 2 years, hopefully revealing even more about the life cycle of the ice fish. One of the researchers said they're looking forward to seeing what the camera captures. It might constitute the first field observation of courtship behavior and or nest preparation, which is some of the things they were observing, some of the oddities or so. So it's fascinating stuff.
And even just the story of this discovery, like they saw one and then another, and then it kept going for miles and miles and miles and miles.
It was in the middle of the night, some grad student researcher who had that night shift.
Said, everyone was asleep except for, one or two people monitoring these cameras. Damn, I mean, it's incredible. There are some neat photos already that are available. I'm sourcing from the New York Times here. There are some great photos and a good story.
All right. Encouraging news. How about that?
We talk about that sense of wonder, Chris, that you can kind of find in nature. And this is one of those things that's a perfect example.
Right in our own
backyard,
so to speak.
Quote, unquote.
Speaking of really fascinating... Swanna, real quick, cheap plug, shameless plug, full moon snowshoe hike?
Yes, full moon snowshoe hikes we are introducing this year. And so you'll see a handful of those this winter. The other thing I wanted to mention, Chris, is that we extended our special exhibit. So that's with us, Survival of the Slowest, the exhibit that talks about animal adaptations, is with us through February 6th.
All right.
So you can come in, meet the animals, and have that experience before it heads out.
And maybe meet some animals in the full moon snowshoe. or at least their tracks.
That's right.
That's what the things. All right. We got to wrap up. Let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah.
Utah Open Lands Conservation Association.
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
San Francisco Design.
And of course, as always, listeners like you, Barb Bratz, for making us aware of our first guest. We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.